You're listening to the Hog Sports Network Daily Podcast. Now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
And good morning. If you're watching us on our Whole Hog Sports Twitter, YouTube, or Facebook pages, we thank you for being here. I'm here with Christina Long, the managing editor of Hogs Illustrated, and she's fresh off the practice field over at Razorback Stadium.
Just came in from practice, first day in pads for Arkansas football.
So how did they look, first day in pads?
Yeah, I mean, it was a mixed bag, I would say. We only get to watch about the first 20 minutes or so, so it can be a little hard to tell. But I would say the most impactful thing we watched today was one-on-one. So quarterbacks throwing to receivers against DBs. And it was not their best day, I would say. I mean, sometimes that happens, like we talked about earlier, with, you know, first day in pads. But I would say it was not their finest day. Just a lot of underthrowing, overthrowing when something was on target, some drops. You know, there were exceptions. There were some guys that made good plays. Isaiah Satania stood out. He made a couple of really nice catches. He's always a guy that I really like watching because he makes catches that you don't think he's going to be able to make. And so he did that a couple of times today. So, I mean, it was mixed, I would say.
I always feel like whenever coaches will talk to you after the first day of pads that they say, you know, it was rusty. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that has been almost every preseason I can think of. It's always a rusty practice that first time in pads, because it's the first time that you put pads on and gone through a full practice since April. There is some acclimation, I think, to it.
Right. I think there definitely is. And, you know, we haven't talked to Sam Pittman in about a week or so. We'll talk to him on Thursday after they scrimmage. Mm-hmm. They'll have a closed scrimmage Thursday, so we won't get to watch any of that. But we'll hear from him about how that went. Today, we'll talk to Ronnie Fauch, the wide receivers coach. So we'll get to talk to him a little bit today about what he saw from the receivers in that drill. And then after, you know, after that, when we left practice, what else kind of happened? Did they get any better? How was the rest of the practice?
What do you want to know about the receivers?
Mainly who is going to step up besides Andrew Armstrong and Tyrone Broden. I mean, those two are the definitive top two. It's been that way since spring. I don't think that's a surprise to anybody after last year. Satania is that third guy. And I think he has a real opportunity this year to take a step forward after he showed some positive signs last season. But I think beyond that, that kind of next tier is a little bit of a mystery. You know, I haven't seen them stand out to me that much in practice. That doesn't mean they've been practicing poorly or they've performed badly. It's just I have not felt them as much in my observation of practice. So talking about like the Isaac Tislaws, the Jordan Anthonys, you know, those kind of guys. So I think that's the biggest question for me is what those guys are going to be able to do when they're needed.
Sometimes players are not good practice players.
Definitely.
And they just step up. And I think about baseball because I've covered baseball. I never thought Peyton Holt was that great of a practice player, but then you put him in the game and he's a total game changer.
He does everything.
And I feel like receivers can be that way too, because it's, I guess every position is repetitive, but I don't know. I feel like maybe you can just kind of get tired of kind of going over the same thing over and over, but you get in the game and some of these guys just have a way to step up and show out, so to speak.
Right. I am always trying to temper my reactions to practice because they're not fully hitting each other. You know, nobody's really tackling. They, like you said, they get tired of going against the same people all the time. They have to be a little bit delicate with each other. Not, you know, 100%, but, you know, you're not trying to hurt your teammates. So it's just, it's, you never truly know until you know. People keep asking me, you know, people in my daily life just asking me, like, what do you think? How do you think the team's going to be? And I just keep telling people, like, we're not going to know till we know.
Nope. Probably not going to know anything till Oklahoma State, to be honest with
you.
I mean, I last year, I have mentioned this before, Chip Souza, who is a columnist for us, he pegged the offensive line struggles that first game against Western Carolina, you know, and he wrote a column saying line play has to get a lot better. And I mean, you could see that they're not pushing people off the line. But I guess where I'm going with this is after you win a game 56-13, it can be very easy just to be, you know, positive. Hey, you won like you're supposed to win. Offensive line play was not good in that first game. And so you're going to be able to see some things, I think, against UAPB in the first game, but you're not going to get a challenge from them. And so, you know, we don't know a whole lot about this team, and I don't think we're going to know a whole lot about them until they actually start playing guys of their own size, so to speak.
Right. It's hard to understate the importance of that Oklahoma State game because, yeah, UAPB will be an important tune-up for them, but it's just Oklahoma State, that's such a big game to have as your second game. And we are really going to learn a lot. And, you know, some teams early in the season, that first or second game, you know, you'll see them come out and you'll see a totally different team later in the season. So mm-hmm. it's not necessarily what they do against Oklahoma State is their identity for the rest of the year, but it's going to be our first clue as to how this season could go.
Patrick Kudus has not been at practice for a few days. Was he back today?
He was not.
Okay. We are probably going to find out what's going on. So just so people know, Sam Pittman was supposed to speak today, but because they changed around their media availability last week, he will not be speaking today. He'll speak Thursday after their scrimmage. So assuming Kudus is not back in practice, it'll probably be Thursday before we really get any type of official word on what's going on there. Anybody else missing at practice?
Yeah, we did not see also on the offensive line Keyshawn Blackstock today. Okay. And then we did not see running back Quindon Jackson today. Okay. He's been there, you know, this is the first day that we've not seen him. Mm-hmm. And then, just Kudus and Blackstock besides that.
Did Pittman say something about have the practice or have the classes ended? Or are they having any type of class conflicts?
I'm not sure. I don't think so right okay. now. I think the summer session is done. I think okay. they're kind of in that break right now. Because I'm not 100% sure, but I think so.
Because that's why they had the late night practices.
Right.
You know, like last year, we were out there with the rooster at 5:30 when practice was beginning that first week. It was early morning practices. Mm-hmm. I mean, early, early morning. I think the first practice last year, I think they started at 6 a.m. This year, it was like 6 p.m. when they were right. having their first practice. And I think he said that was due to class
right.
issues.
Class. And then also, yeah, they would have liked to do the morning because the big problem is the heat, too. Mm-hmm. And so, but it was easier to do it in the evening. They moved one practice to 7 p.m. and it was so much cooler. I mean, it was crazy how much of a difference the 2 hours made from the 5 p.m. to the 7 p.m. It was so much cooler. The 9 a.m. has been better, too. So they've been 9 a.m. This week and will be, I think, for the next week as well.
So you and Ethan Westerman wrote something on our website last night, a mailbag, mm-hmm. answering some questions, just basically asking your thoughts from week one of practice. What are some of the things that have stood out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the number one thing we talked a little bit about, the biggest question being some of the receivers. I think some of the one my biggest question is, again, going to come back to the quarterbacks. I mean, I think we talked with Coach Petrino and with Sam Pittman in the spring about, you know, Taylen Green has shown some accuracy issues in his mm-hmm. time at Boise State. The idea has been that Bobby Petrino, as a quarterback whisperer, can kind of bring that out of him, can work with him, can play to his strengths while improving some of those weaknesses. And I think we've seen a little bit of that. But I mean, I think as we just talked about, we won't know till we know, and mm-hmm. we'll have to see what he does against true competition. So I think that is probably my biggest concern and question right now. The other things would be the linebackers and how that group is going to shake out. I think that's also the biggest depth question mark. Mm-hmm. I mean, they lost all of their experience last year, truly all of it. I mm-hmm. mean, they had guys that were on the team, but not guys that played a lot of meaningful snaps. They get some transfers that they're going to probably play, but they get sort of an interesting group there where it's hard to say for sure who is going to be the biggest contributors. You know, we know that Brad Spence and Georgia transfer Xavien Story have been with the ones this whole time, but does that mean they're going to be the starters all year? I don't know. You know, they have a couple of transfers. Steven Dix is one of them who will be a linebacker. And then they've got a couple of guys. I wrote on this yesterday, a couple of transfers who are kind of flex defensive backs, nickels, linebackers that they can kind of move around a lot. So I think that's another thing that I'll be watching once the season starts is how they use those guys. The other things that have stood out, I mentioned Isaiah Satania. I think he really is poised to step up this year. I think just with the situation they have, in the slot, I think he really has a good opportunity. Bobby Petrino said he thought he could be like a Joe Adams type player. I mean, he'll mm-hmm. be in the return game and they mm-hmm. need a lot from him in the return game. They're going to lean on him a lot. Jalen Braxton has also worked back there. And then Jordan Anthony, who's kind of the track sprinter guy. Mm-hmm. They mentioned Monte Harrison as well as somebody, the former MLB player, right. As somebody who's going to return. I would not expect to see him returning a lot of kicks or punts. Satania is going to be the main one. But I would expect a lot from Satania this year. I think he has a great opportunity.
Satania and Anthony remind me a little bit of, I'm not saying they're as good as Joe Adams, but they remind me of that, you know, when Petrino was here the first time, they just found ways to get Joe Adams' ball. One of the you know, creative plays, I guess, that I remember from Joe Adams was against Auburn in 2011. They lined him up as a running back, pitched a, you know, just simple quick pitch out to him. He gets a great block downfield, I think, from Chris Gregg, the tight end, and he goes 92 yards for a touchdown that turned a game that was between a couple of top 25 teams. We saw what he could do in the punt return game. We saw what Satania could do, you know, as a punt returner last year. had a touchdown returning against BYU. He reminds me of Adams, mm-hmm. and I think Anthony could potentially be in that same, you know, conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Anthony's got the speed for sure. We'll see how he is as a receiver and as a returner. I haven't seen a ton from him just in the practice periods we've watched so far, but I mean, I think they're excited about him, especially for the speed component.
Position battles right now. What's standing out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned linebacker. I think the defensive line is set, but the defensive line depth is a concern. And so mm-hmm. I think that kind of two defensive line is a big area where we've seen a lot of shuffling. I also think offensive line, similar concept, the depth at offensive line, how those guys are going to stack up, especially, you know, we don't know the status of some of these injuries. I have, you know, I don't think they'll hold them out for the season. I don't know. We haven't mm-hmm. been told what those injuries are. But I think some of those backup positions, we'll see kind of where they line up and how they shake out. I know they expect a lot from Tykes Crawford. He's a guy that's been here a long time and has kind of been trying to break through, and they expect a lot from him. And he's kind of battling with Syracuse transfer Joe Moore and a couple of those other guys to kind of see A, where they want to place them, where they would be best positioned. And then mm-hmm. also who is going to be the best five, who is going to be the best of that group.
Fernando Carmona.
Yeah.
What have been your thoughts? Because the chatter that I hear about him is very positive.
Yeah. I mean, he is a guy that they are really, really high on. I mean, he was highly rated coming in. You know, mm-hmm. he is somebody that they're looking at as a draft pick in the future. And Sam Pittman, I mean, when I spoke with him this summer for our football preview magazine, he said Carmona is the guy. I mean, they kind of structured this offensive line around him. And so I think they expect a lot from him. They need him to have a great season. And I think he's capable of it. I think he's been really impressive and definitely the top guy on that offensive line.
The thing to me is and I feel like if you lined Arkansas's top 22 up against a lot of other teams' top 22, it's probably comparable. It's not Georgia. It's not Alabama. And we wouldn't mistake it for that. But, you know, I think maybe once you get past the fifth, sixth best team in the SEC, the depth is the difference right now. And that is what, you know, this practice season – I think is really what they're focused on is building depth, because you know that you're not going to be able to have your linebackers play 90% of the snaps, or if they do, you could end up with a situation like you had a few years ago where Bumper Pool and Grant Morgan both just broke down, you know, by the end of the season. Chris Paul was able to step up at the end, but you didn't see a lot of him early in that year. And so I feel like the depth is really the question for Arkansas this preseason more than starting roles. I'm more interested maybe to see, you know, who's the number two, and is number two ready to be number one if he's called upon.
Right. I would totally agree with that. And I think especially on defense, you know, when we were starting to preview this team, I was looking back at returning starters, and they return a lot of experience on the defense. But there is that question of, like you said, that depth, and who else do they have? What are their other options? Who can rotate in and who can they rely on? And I think that's something that they're wondering about. And that's what these couple weeks are about, is figuring that out. And we'll see, you know, once they actually hit the field. Like you said, some people are gamers and we'll see. But I would say defense especially, that's a big concern.
You grew up around the program. Is Bobby Petrino's demeanor what it used to be?
You know, I felt like what we saw in spring especially was, you know, I know Ethan talked a little bit yesterday about him being a little bit more of a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I think he's definitely, you know, he's older now. He's seen more. I think you'll get those moments. You'll get those, somebody, you know, sets him off, and you'll mm-hmm. get those moments of fire and energy. It's funny. His voice carries, you know, like you can hear him above everybody else and you know, it's him. It's very distinct. So that's been kind of fun, but, no, I mean, I don't think it's quite the level of, the fabled Bobby Petrino practices that we'd heard before, but I don't think that's a bad thing.
How much do you think he can affect this team? Because last year the problem was on offense, and I wrote this in the football preview. If you took what Texas A&M was able to do from an efficiency standpoint on offense, and I know they had different players, but they were playing a lot of the same teams Arkansas was playing. If you took what they did efficiency-wise and you applied that to Arkansas, they're not a 4-win team. They're maybe a 7-8-win team in the regular season last year. That's how close they were. Field goal loss to, you know, Alabama, a touchdown loss to Ole Miss, obviously the BYU game, the Mississippi State game is the one that really stands out. You get a different offensive coordinator in there, or, you know, at least different offensive production, And it looks, we're talking about this team, I think, a lot differently this year.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think he will have a huge impact. I mean, Pittman has been very clear that, like, this is Bobby's offense. I am here to kind of direct. I am a sounding board. I am, you know, asking questions. I'm making some decisions. But, like, this is Bobby's show as far as the offense, you know? And so I think he will have a tremendous impact. You know, that was the big thing at Texas A&M was how much of this is really Petrino's, you know? And so that was the big thing. So I think this, you know, the offense you will see will be truly Petrino's offense. There will be no muddling.
When I was in College Station for baseball back in May, I was talking to some A&M reporters and, you know, they wanted kind of my take on what Petrino looked like in the spring. And that was their takeaway. It was, if he was able to do his own thing last year, it would have been a totally different season for A&M. I think there probably has to be some refreshment on his part that he goes from a situation where it felt like he was wearing some handcuffs to he goes to a situation where he has total freedom.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be an interesting part of his career. You know, he's now had so many different stops, and he's been a head coach, he's now been a coordinator, you know, NFL stops, and then now, like you said, he's had those two very different, you know, types of workplaces almost, you know, in a short span of time. And so I think he's well positioned for that. You know, this is not his first rodeo by any means. This is not the first time he's been given the keys to an offense, you know? So I think, you know, I'm sure if you ask him, this is much preferred. So I think we'll see what he's able to do with Talen and with some of these other pieces and how much he's able to help them improve and put them together. But I think this is definitely his show.
You can read all of Christina's coverage on WholeHogSports.com. There you can get the latest breaking news on all Razorback sports, most in-depth source for Arkansas sports. Our award-winning team of reporters and photographers bring subscribers the most trusted news. We have analysis from Christina, Ethan, and others, latest in recruiting from Richard Davenport, unique stories on all your favorite Razorback teams. You can subscribe today at WholeHogSports.com. Christina, it's interesting for you because you spent last year at Clemson, so you saw how and I know Clemson hasn't won a championship in a few years, but I would still consider it a championship-level program. What do you see from Arkansas that is similar and different from what you saw in Clemson?
Yeah, I mean, Clemson is a very interesting place. I was really glad for myself to get that experience to see another program. Clemson is, I think there's so much of it that is built around Dabo Swinney, and so I think in some ways it is very unique in that, you know, I don't think any coach necessarily could recreate exactly what Dabo has done.
Probably,
you know,
not.
For better or worse.
Yeah.
And so I think some of the differences there are just kind of the cult of personality that he has and the way, you know, culture is a word that gets thrown around so much in college football, and whether it means something or it doesn't, you know, I think at Clemson it actually really does. And it's something that they have they really, really lean into it. And that is just what they go for. I mean, they are living and dying by this guy and this group and, you know, the kind of beliefs that they have, I guess, for lack of a better term. And so I think it's hard to say what the similarities are. I would say Clemson definitely feels like a step up. And I think some of that is the resource situation, just as far as what Clemson puts into football. But yeah, it's hard to say what similarities and differences are, because I do feel like Clemson has just been under the same person. They have that level of consistency. They've been under the same person for so long, and he has been executing his vision for so long that now it is just so, I mean, it's in the walls.
Do you think they could fit in the SEC? You know, there's a lot of talk about what's going on with them in the ACC.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you mean by fit. I think, you know, obviously culturally, for sure. Whether or not they will get that invite, I don't know. Because when you think about it, you know, we always talk about TV markets are what's driving everything these days. They already, the SEC has the South Carolina market locked down. They are all in. So they don't necessarily need Clemson from that standpoint. Clemson does bring a lot in terms of viewership, culture, you know, they are a large brand. People know Clemson football. So, I mean, I think they would fit in if the SEC wanted them.
It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because there have been some reports that the SEC is not interested in Clemson and Florida State, and it would make sense. I don't know what they add to the SEC other than they do have football teams that have won, and there is some value in that. But I also think the SEC is continually wanting to stretch into new markets. And so you wonder about, you know, if they expand, and Sankey has been very adamant that they're not looking to expand. They're happy with 16 teams. If they expand, do they go into a market where they have somebody, and you run the risk of really upsetting one of the teams that you have, similar to A&M or Texas? Or do you go to a North Carolina you go to a Virginia and try to expand your conference there. We're going to have more with Christina coming up here on our podcast.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
And we welcome you back into the studio here in downtown Fayetteville with Christina Long. I'm Matt Jones. We appreciate you. We're talking about Razorback football this morning. Christina has been over at the Razorback Stadium going through the Razorback sixth practice of the preseason. Is it number six?
I think it's six. Yeah. It all runs together.
It started a week ago tomorrow.
Right.
And they have one day off. So yes. I think we're at number six and we are 23 days from the Razorbacks season opener against Arkansas Pine Bluff. Down in Little Rock. This is the latest Hogs Illustrated. It's actually kind of a little bit dated at this point. It previews the Paris Olympics and all the Razorbacks who are in it. A ton of Razorbacks are in the Olympics this year. You know, we've been keeping track of it. We talked about it yesterday that Arkansas had two volunteer coaches win medals, including Ryan Krauser winning the gold medal in the shot put over the weekend. They had a couple of sprinters medal in the mixed 1600 relay. You had Amber Anning, bronze for Great Britain, and Kaylin Brown, silver medal for the United States in that. And of course, Kaylin had the great, the great world record, I guess, clinching run. She was on the anchor leg of that 1600 meter relay in the prelims. Hogs Illustrated, we print 20 times a year. You can see over my shoulder, we've got our football preview up there. You can stay on top of all your Razorback sports with a digital subscription to the Hogs Illustrated app. You can get the most complete Razorback coverage in one location. Subscription will give you 20 plus issues of Hogs Illustrated magazine each year. And complete access to all of our content at wholehogsports.com. You can get that with a subscription to HI. At Whole Hog, we've got breaking news, commentaries, analysis, features, recruiting, award-winning photos. I don't feel like our photographers get mentioned enough at Whole Hog. Guys like Hank Layton and Charlie Cajo and Andy Shoup and Caleb Greiger, they do a great job taking photos for us at games all over the place. They were at the Arkansas-Kansas soccer game the other night. Premium message boards also on our website. Monthly subscription at HI begins at $17. You can join our team right now at hogsillustrated.com/subscribe, or you can call 479-684-5509 to get your front row pass to Razorback Sports. Hogs Illustrated, Christina has been our fearless leader at HI for the last, what are we at, about 8.5 months now?
Yeah, something like that. Somewhere started in January, so.
What have we got on tap for our next magazine?
Yeah, our next magazine is going to be our first football magazine. It's going to be our first football season one. We'll go weekly starting then. So that'll be out just before the UAPB game. It'll be kind of previewing that, looking ahead to the season on the whole. We have some exciting stuff planned for some of our football coverage this season. We'll have some other sports in there too. There'll be some soccer. You know, that's something we really want to lean into this year is adding in some of those other sports. We got to do a lot of that in the spring, especially, you know, we did a lot of basketball, a lot of baseball, but we also had plenty of softball, you know, some gymnastics, things like that. So that's something that I really like about the magazine is we get to add a lot of other coverage. We really do cover the, I guess you could say, the whole hog. So it's really fun. So yeah, we'll have plenty of football, all that you'll need for the past game, recapping the past game, previewing the future game, and then giving you some other in-depth coverage of the team plus some other sports.
I don't know how many copies of the football preview that we have left, but if you do subscribe, you can check out our football preview on our website on the digital version. I thought our football preview looked, as good as it ever has this year. So congratulations to you on that. A lot of good information still in that football preview that's pertinent leading up to game one. The USA Today, I'm sorry, it's not the USA Today coaches poll anymore. Did you notice this? They've changed the
USLBM. It actually was, I think, last year too.
Okay.
I think it was sponsored by them last year. I think it maybe started mid-season. It's funny.
The coaches poll came out yesterday. And of course, as is the case every year, you expect to see a lot of Arkansas opponents. There's seven of them on this. You got Texas at number four, Ole Miss at number six, Missouri 11, LSU 12, Tennessee 15, Oklahoma State 18, and Texas A&M is number 20. But what caught my eye was the number of teams that are in the top 25 that are in new leagues this year. You got Oregon is number 3, Texas, we mentioned, Utah is in there, Oklahoma coming to the SEC, Arizona going to the Big 12, Southern Cal going to the Big 10. You never know what it's going to be like going into a new conference, right? And so that's one of the really interesting things for me this season. I guess we could start in the SEC with Texas and OU, but really across the board, how do these teams that have done so well for so many years and are, you know, they expect to win so big, how do they do going into, in most cases, tougher conferences?
Right. I mean, that's going to be the story of this season, is all of these moves. I mean, you could have Big Ten champion Oregon, which is just a bizarre thing to say. Even now, we've been in this month, we've known this is happening, and I still get a little hung up on it. But I think when you look specifically at Texas and Oklahoma, they have been prepping for this for a while. The coaches they have are the coaches that they wanted to kind of lead them into this change. They wanted to set that up. They wanted to have that foundation. They have been positioning themselves to succeed in this jump for a long time. We'll see how that plays out. I mean, I think Texas is best positioned. I think they are right now. They look like they'll be better than Oklahoma. Oklahoma had a mixed couple of seasons under Venables, but I think he's kind of righted the ship a little bit. They have a lot of changes there, you know, new quarterback, new things like that. So we'll see. But I mean, I think what's most interesting to me, I think, about all these changes is what it does to kind of the middle of the leagues. How a team like Arkansas, you know, what happens for a team like Arkansas when you now add more to the top of this conference, you know, these teams that are coming in with almost a leg up, you
makes
know,
the mountain harder to climb.
It does. It absolutely does. And it does that in multiple sports. I know you wrote about this, you know, when Texas and Oklahoma officially joined, but what it does in each sport, you know, you look at softball, these are two elite softball programs. Arkansas has a great softball program. They're still trying to make their first Women's College World Series. They have an even more uphill battle than they've had. And they're now competing against two of the top programs in the country historically.
Probably the two top.
Yeah.
They've played
absolutely
in two of the last three national championships.
So, you know, and football obviously is the headliner. And I think what happens to teams that are typically behind those top few, that kind of second tier historically, what happens with them and how much harder it is for them to advance will be what's interesting to watch over the next few years.
What stands out to me are the conferences. And of course, you know, you've got the SEC at 16 teams now. Big Ten is at 18. I almost want to call it the Big 18.
I know, because, it's huge.
But SEC's got 9 teams. Big Ten's got 6. That's 15 of your top 25 right there. Big 12's got 5. ACC has 4. And then you've got Notre Dame. It feels to me like, you know, so over the last 10 years or so, we've talked about Power 5, Group of 5. It almost feels like we're adding a third tier right now to college football. You've got the SEC and the Big Ten plus Notre Dame, because they've got a huge seat at the table. That's tier one. Tier two is the Big 12 and the ACC. And tier three is everybody else in FBS.
Yeah.
And I don't really see any way that the Big 12 and the ACC are going to close that gap. You might have a championship level team in those conferences. Florida State, it wouldn't surprise anybody if they were a championship team this year. But top to bottom, nobody is competing with what the SEC and the Big Ten are doing right now.
Right, absolutely. And I think it's been funny to, over this change, hear how we talk about, how different people that talk about college football, how they talk about these conferences, because you used to have Power 5, Group of 5. Now it's funny to hear how the terms are evolving. And
Power 4, I'm still getting used to that.
We're hearing Power 4, I'm hearing Power 2, I'm hearing Big 2, you know, I'm hearing, you know, like, so it's just interesting. I'm not hearing like Group of 7 or whatever, but it's just, it's interesting to see as we kind of fumble around for how we talk about this now, because the framing has been the same for so long, and how do we frame that now? But I think, you know, the Big 12 is trying. The Big 12 is, you know, they made those additions. I think the Big 12 is going to be an exciting league this year. I mean, I think there's going to be good football, and it's going to be, it feels pretty wide open. I mean, there's a lot of teams in there that can contend. So I think that will be a fun conference to watch. What they do over the next few years as these things continue to shift, because realignment is not done, we're going to see more. What they do, what happens to them will be interesting. The ACC obviously feels very precarious. What happens to them? What happens to them if their top brands leave for that Power 2? Do they go the way of the Pac-12? Do they bring some other teams up? So those will be, I mean, the things to watch, and we might see that play out sooner rather than later.
couple other SEC headlines. Did you see what happened over in South Carolina Saturday night? They had Liverpool and Manchester United at Williams-Brice Stadium.
I didn't realize that had happened this weekend. When I was in Destin for SEC spring meetings, I was talking to a group of South Carolina writers and some staffers about how they got that organized. And it was so interesting. One thing we talked about was when they were kind of visiting with those teams and with brass from those teams and kind of planning this out. Figuring out what hotels they were going to put them in, because these professional soccer players are used to staying in the best hotels there are in the most beautiful cities in the world. Like, that's where do they stay in Columbia, South Carolina?
Well, and you know, like when cities can't get the NCAA tournament unless they have a certain number of hotels that meet a certain criteria, right? Or like even in Omaha, College World Series, there are a lot of really nice high scale hotels in downtown Omaha near the stadium. So that's interesting that you say that. It's one of the reasons I think Fayetteville, and I don't know if Fayetteville's really looked into having an NCAA tournament here, but even if they looked into having something at Bud Walton Arena, I don't know if they could, because I don't think the hotel situation in Northwest Arkansas is up to par. They had over 77,000 people at the game. And I was looking this, the Charlotte Observer wrote a story about this. They said the largest attendance for a South Carolina home football game last year was 80,000 against Clemson. So, I mean, it's a big deal that they had. I remember Arkansas a few years, man, it's probably been, it might have been 10, 12 years ago, they looked into having a, I think it was a World Cup qualifier here at Razorback Stadium. It was very preliminary, talking about, taking bids for World Cup qualifiers. I remember Arkansas looked into it. I don't think anything ever happened there, but it's kind of crazy that you can get 77,000 people in Williams-Brice Stadium to watch a soccer match between two international teams.
Yeah, and I remember they were talking too about how they weren't sure how they should price some of their premium seating and their suites and clubs. They weren't sure if they should make it really expensive or what. So they kind of undersold it, and so they ended up making a lot more than they thought they would because people were willing to pay for it.
We will have, Christina, thanks for being here. We're going to have Mark Etheridge from D1Baseball.com with us when we come back. We're going to talk to him about the SEC baseball offseason, also the Major League Baseball draft, and how that affected SEC teams. We'll be back in just a moment.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
And welcome back in. We'll get to Mark Rethage from D1Baseball.com here in just a minute. Bentonville Glass is one of our sponsors, serving his community since 1971. Committed, professional, and versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas and looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them at 507 South Main in Bentonville or at BentonvilleGlass.com. Mark Etheridge has covered SEC baseball for a long time. He works for D1Baseball.com right now. And last year, he and Joe Healy launched a new initiative kind of at D1Baseball where you actually, Mark, you and Joe focus exclusively on SEC baseball. So I thought you'd be great to have in here to talk about the SEC offseason. How's everything going?
Going great, Matt. Nice to visit with you today.
You know, Sauce Nagel to Texas is the big story of the SEC offseason. But setting that aside for a minute, because I do want to talk about that, what have been some of the other things that have stood out since the World Series ended a month or so ago?
Well, I think LSU, after having a down year by their standards, really went all in, have improved their roster. That was certainly one. I think Georgia, a lot of us were pleasantly surprised at how well they did last year, first year under Wes Johnson, went heavy in the portal year one. And you know what? They've done the same thing again this year. And I think they're going to have a similar type of roster minus Charlie Condon, but they look like another team that's that's helped themselves. And then I think some players coming back. I mean, Florida getting Colby Shelton back was big. They also got Ty Evans back. Those were players we didn't expect. I mentioned LSU, Jared Jones coming back. That was a guy most of us felt would be in pro ball by now. Those were probably the bigger things, but yeah, the epicenter was that, you know, College Station to Austin, 100 or so miles that kind of swallowed up everything, you know, earlier this summer.
And it just so turned out that happened as Texas is joining the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot remember from a coaching standpoint, I cannot remember a bigger story in SEC baseball in the offseason than Sauce Nagel going from A&M to Texas. It seemed like it transcended just kind of our little world of college baseball. You had people talking about this, it seemed like everywhere you turned in June.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's kind of one of the things that as you talk to people inside the sport, it's like, yeah, it was great that our sport got all this extra publicity. We just wish it wasn't that, right? and I do think that obviously the way that Jim Schlossnagel handled his exit, the press conference in Omaha, that was just a disaster. He handled that about as poorly as he could. Oh, yeah. And then, you know, and to his credit, he apologized for that later. It's kind of, you know, you understand there's not going to be an easy way to leave for your rival. And moments after you lose the national championship game, and plus you have this incredible roster with all these high expectations for the following year, and then you leave, you can imagine, you know, if you put yourself in the A&M fan standpoint, not only is he leaving, he's taking all of our good players because they all went in the portal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, you're thinking this is the worst possible scenario for us. You know, we really had the program in great shape. And now Texas, of all people, come in here and steal the architect of this turnaround for A&M. However, a funny thing happened on the way to the disaster in College Station. Michael Early got the job. You know, he was the hitting coach, and as you well know, Texas A&M's been one of the best hitting teams under Jim Schlossnagel. And the thing about Michael, I talked to him earlier, really right after he got the job, and he's a really personable guy. He's a guy everyone, you know, enjoys being around. And some of those players and some of the people around the program really went to bat for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that got his foot in the door. And, of course, you see that a lot of times. They give the, quote, courtesy interview for the guy who's, you know, either on staff or has connections to the staff. And that's as far as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the case here. He went in, he came in with a plan. He knew what he was good at. He knew where his, maybe his holes were in his resume. And he was able to fill that and really impress Trev Alberts enough to get that second look. And then the following day, he got the offer. And it's really one of the most fascinating hires, you know, not to mention, you know, Schlossnagel leaving, but then who they fill the role with. And not only did he get the job, but he brought back the majority of the players from the portal. And right now, Texas A&M looks like if they're not number one, they're number two in the preseason. I mean, that's a really good-looking lineup. They've got Ryan Prager, who was their ace, third-round draft choice, decided to come back to school, got a really nice NIL package. He's going to lead their rotation again. And this looks like this looks like the preseason number one team in the country.
And if not A&M, probably LSU.
They're 1-2. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we just put something on D1 Baseball on our SEC Extra site, kind of looking back at last year and then looking ahead to next year. And in there, there's a projected lineup as we head into the fall. Obviously, things are going to change based on who performs and who doesn't. But just looking at those two teams, I mean, they're going to be – they're absolutely loaded heading into the fall.
Who are the other teams to watch in 2025?
Yeah, I think obviously the defending or the reigning national champion, Tennessee, they lost a lot, but there's plenty of talent coming back, and they added some guys that are really going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
I think Florida will be improved. You know, in the regular season, we think about them having a bad year, but they finished in the College World Series semifinals, so it turned out to be, you know, a pretty strong team. I think Georgia is going to be really good. I think Arkansas is going to be good. It's the question is with the transfers, are they going to hit enough? You know, some of them have pretty good, production in their past. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be able to step into the SEC and perform maybe better than some of the guys did a year ago? I think, you know, outside the SEC, Florida State's going to be really good. I think they're one of those top five kind of teams. In Oregon State, which is a fascinating deal because there's no Pac-12 anymore. Mm-hmm. So Oregon State's playing more of an independent schedule. So that'll be fascinating just to see, you know, how that looks schedule-wise, how they're able to maintain that program that's kind of in a little bit of a purgatory right now.
You know what's amazing, Mark, is you listed off those teams. You didn't say Vanderbilt. You didn't say Texas. You didn't say Kentucky, who was just the SEC champion and had a great year that ended in Omaha. You didn't say South Carolina, who always seems to be there. The Mississippi schools. This is insane how good this league is top to bottom. You can be a really good SEC team. Florida was this way this year. I think what they finished like in a tie for 11th.
Yeah.
You can be way down the totem pole in the SEC and still be a really elite team.
Yeah, and it's going to be fascinating to see how people, and we're going to see this in all sports, but I think it may be even more prevalent in baseball, how little conference records are going to matter. Because the top teams in the country are playing each other and they're unbalanced schedules within that group. And you're going to have a team that's, you know, in years past, if you went 14 and 16, you were a bubble team, you know, 14, 16 in conference play, you were a bubble team. And I think now you're going to be 14 and 16. And, you know, if you might be a game away from hosting because the league is, your RPI is going to be really high. It's, I think that's going to be different. And, you know, we're going to look at these clubs that you know, maybe finish 10th or 11th, 12th in a conference, but the conferences are so big and all the power has been consolidated into those leagues. You're going to see those teams competing to host, and people outside those leagues are going to just cry. Right. And how can you be the 10th or 11th best team in your conference and be one of the best in the country? And that's the, you know, that's the sea change that we're going through, you know, one of the many changes in our sport right now, but conference consolidation and realignment has led to a different way to evaluate power as we look at, you know, postseason.
You heard Chad Holbrook at the end of the regular season when College of Charleston didn't get in. He pretty much made that same argument that you were just referencing. He said, you know, I went 13 and 17 in that league and I got fired.
Yeah.
Florida does it. And he didn't mention Florida by name, but that's, I think we all agree that's who he was probably referencing. And then, you know, they go on this great run. They win in Stillwater. They win in Clemson. And, you know, they keep winning on till I think the semifinals of the World Series.
Yeah. It does show just, you know, if you're outside the conference, outside the SEC, it's going to be that much more challenging to get that benefit of the doubt when you're being evaluated against an SEC team. And whether that's right or wrong, you know, it's not for me to say, but that's going to be reality going forward. And I think the other part of that is with the transfer portal. So many of the top mid-majors are losing their best players or their up-and-coming players to the SEC and all of that. It's not just the power from the, you know, the best coaches are going there, the best recruit, you know, prep players, but you're also getting transfers that want to play, you know, on these big stages and great atmospheres and all of that good stuff. I don't know that it's particularly healthy for the overall sport, but that's, you know, that's reality right now.
You know, I think we saw that a little bit in the draft. A lot of really good prep players were pulling out of the Major League Baseball draft and saying, I'm going to go to LSU. I'm going to go to Tennessee. I'm going to go wherever. Arkansas, they get Carson Wiggins and Cole Gibler, a couple of top pitchers in the high school class to end up coming to Fayetteville. Which teams do you think were hurt the most by the draft in terms of, I mean, I guess you could say either their roster from 24 and their class or maybe just their signing class, but which ones were hurt the most and which ones came out of it the best?
Well, Kentucky is a really interesting story along those lines because, I mean, they lost just about everybody from that great team, their best team in program history. Had some guys that, you know, also had a few guys transfer out. It's going to be a totally different team. However, they added the highest ranked player not to sign, Tyler Bells, freshman, second rounder, switch hitting shortstop. So you lost volume, but you picked up, you know, arguably the best guy out there. So that was interesting to me. Mississippi State was a team that, you know, David Marchand was a late, right at the signing deadline. He was their shortstop last year, really good player. He ended up signing professionally. Dakota Jordan, who I think we all felt he would sign, but it was late. It was the last couple of days before signing day. They also lost Travis Smith, who was a Kentucky pitcher last year. It was their Friday guy early in the year and then didn't end up there. But he had transferred to Mississippi State, and he ended up signing late. So it's, you know, they were a team that they got hurt by the draft. However, it could have been worse because Hunter Hines, their big slugging first baseman that we all felt would go, didn't. He wasn't drafted at all. And so he'll be back to try to lead that offense. So, yeah, there's been some interesting, you know, interesting teams that lost guys that we kind of felt. I alluded to this earlier with Jared Jones and Colby Shelton. Mm-hmm. You know, those were draft-eligible sophomores, and a lot of times, you know, they have more leverage because they've got more eligibility left, and they returned. And I think the other thing I would mention here is with – players coming in from other teams through the portal, we've kind of forget about these prep players who come in and turn down, you know, big time money. Like LSU's got Cade Aaron Beattie, who's probably going to be their starting catcher as a freshman. He obviously could have signed. Derek Curiel's an outfielder. He's got a chance to play. He was another, you know, top 100 type of a player. And then they got two pitchers. Cooper Williams, who was a Texas A&M recruit, and then with coaching change, he ended up moving on. And then William Schmidt, another freshman, come in. LSU's, you know, they always have those great prep players come in, and they got, you know, another batch of them this year.
We'll get you out of here on this, Mark. Last few years, Chase Dahlander, Paul Skeens, Braden Montgomery, you can go down the list. Billy Amick was big for Tennessee in their championship run this year. The transfers that come into this conference are some of the really big names in the sport. Arkansas, you mentioned, they've got a lot of transfers this year. A couple of the notables, Landon Beidelsees, the left-hander from Ohio State. You got Zach Root, a left-hander coming in from East Carolina, a really good pitcher. Who are some of the other transfers elsewhere that you think we ought to keep an eye on in 25?
Yeah, I think Auburn adding Cade Fisher, who was at Florida last year, is going to be a big deal for them. They really needed help on the mound, and he's probably their Friday guy. I would look at Kyle Jones going from Stetson to Florida. He was one of the best players in the A-Sun for Stetson, and he'll step right into center field there. I would say maybe another one to watch would be Robbie Burnett. He was a guy he went from UNC Asheville to Georgia. A lot of people felt like he was going to be a, you know, top draft choice. He decided to go to Georgia instead as a transfer. And then probably as I go through here, I would say another one to watch would be at Texas bringing in Ethan Mendoza from Arizona State. He's probably going to be their second baseman. And Thomas Burns, who was Arizona State's Friday guy before he got hurt. And there's a good chance he steps right in as the ace for Texas. And, you know, as they kind of rebuild that roster under Schlossnagel.
Mark, good stuff. We appreciate your time. And where can people find your coverage?
Yeah, D1 Baseball. We are the site to follow if you're a college baseball nut, like I know you are, Matt. And Joe Healy and I have this extra. SEC Extra package where you can go in and, like, right now we're going through and looking ahead to the lineup. All these names that we rattled off when we were talking, they'll be included in that as we look ahead to see what these teams are going to look like next year with all these personnel losses, the portal giving and taking, and all the these how the players were affected by the draft.
Well, Mark, we appreciate it, and we'll definitely be reading this offseason.
Thanks, Matt. You take care.
All right. Mark Etheridge of D1Baseball.com. We appreciate you being with us today on our podcast. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow at 10 a.m. with Ethan Westerman here to talk about Razorback football. Until then, go to WholeHogSports.com to see all of our latest coverage. Have a good day, everyone.